Due to its length, this episode of Beyond Reality is divided into two parts. The interview with Marla Freeze starts here in part one and then concludes in the subsequent episode as part two. Please enjoy it all and thanks for listening.
The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I almost, you know, missed this intro because I'm busy saying hello to people in our chat rooms. And there are more and more people all the time, so there are more and more hellos I have to, give out. If I miss anybody, I'm sorry. It's just it starts scrolling fast, and I'm trying to get ready to hit the go live button, and sometimes I miss people, but I know I'll try to catch up as we go along here. We've got a great show for you tonight. We're excited to have Marla Freeze joining us. Marla is a world-renowned transformational psychic medium. She was an actress for a while as well, a fairly high-profile actress, did a lot of work in television and film, and we're going to talk about that, why she gave that up, and why she turned her attention to being what she is now, a transformational psychic medium, why that work is something that has taken a priority over everything else that she was doing previously. So it's going to be a great conversation. And again, Marla Freeze will be our guest. I want to take a moment here because I meant to do this. Gosh, I think I wanted to do this last week and I just kept forgetting. And then I was going to do it again Monday, then Tuesday, forgot both of those nights. So we're going to try it tonight. We've had a lot of people join us and help support the program on our Patreon channel. That channel is very, very easy to find. I certainly don't demand or even ask very seriously that people do that. But if you can support the program through the Patreon channel, it's really, really very much appreciated. And we've had a bunch of people do that recently, and I've neglected to thank them and say hello. So I want to take a minute and do that now. A couple of our frequent chatters in our chat room joined our Patreon ranks. Wendy White and Diane Wilson both are supporting the show through Patreon. Thank you so much to both of you. And also thank you very much for being in the chat room. It's really, really nice and a pleasure to see you there almost every night, both of you. Also supporting the Patreon channel very recently, David Check and Jamie Paris. And I don't think I have seen either of them in our chat rooms. Maybe I've missed it. If you haven't, David or Jamie, please join us. And the way you can find the chat room, in case you're listening through the podcast version of the show, which would be, there would be no chat room associated with that. You can find it by going to either our YouTube channel or our Twitch channel. Either one, either platform, if you just search for JV Johnson, you'll find it. And when we are live, there is a chat room in both. But again, thank you to everybody. We've got quite a long list of people that support us in in our Patreon channel, our Patreon page, and it does help us with our efforts to produce the program. So thank you very much for all of you for doing that. And for those of you who support the show in other ways, we thank you too. It's very, very important. Your effort to share it with your social media friends and to talk about it in other chat rooms and other posts and just being here night after night, day after day. That's what really, really helps the show continue. So thank you all so very much. Again, tonight we're going to be talking with Marla Freeze. Marla is a transformational psychic medium, and we're going to talk about her life because her book, American Psychic, From the Heartland to Hollywood, Heaven and Beyond, actually reveals Marla's extraordinary life journey. Started out in a small town. Many of us did that. And she grew up in a troubled family. She became a stage and TV actress. And ultimately, as she is now, one of the country's most respected transformational psychic mediums. So it's going to be a very fascinating conversation, as they always are here. I really do. And by the way, thank you to the kind words from our guest last night. John Gastel sent Slick Eddie an email about his how much he enjoyed being on the show last night. That's always really kind of our guests to do that, to go out of the way to connect after the show, and I appreciate it. And I also very much appreciate the kind words, because your time, the time that you commit to being on this program, is more than I can ever expect or ask from anyone. And when you do that, I'm so very, very appreciative. So thanks for taking the extra effort to send that note John. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have our guest on, and we'll be talking about Marla Freese's work as a transformational psychic medium. It's beyond reality, and we'll be right back.
Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W.
And tonight I find it very funny that those of you who are watching in one of our video streams, whether it is the YouTube stream or the Twitch channel, either way, are pretty excited that I actually have a shirt on that is not either gray, blue, or black. Because as you all know, for years now, that's almost what I wear exclusively. This is, I don't even know, this might be salmon? Rust color? I'm not sure. And I don't even know why I'm wearing it, frankly, because I'm much more comfortable in gray, blue, or black. Anyway, well, welcome back to the program. We've got a fantastic show for you tonight. I'm very excited about this. Our guest tonight, Marla Freese, is a transformational psychic medium. She's written a book. It's actually a memoir called American Psychic from the Heartland to Hollywood, Heaven and Beyond, and reveals Marla's extraordinary life journey. From a small-town girl and a troubled family to a stage and TV actress career, and then ultimately becoming one of the country's most respected transformational psychic mediums. Marla, welcome to Beyond Reality. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much, JV. Me too.
We like to have a lot of fun on the program, and your story sounds like it might have been fun at times, challenging at other times, and in some cases it may have been something that most people would have just thrown in the towel and said, "The heck with this, I'm just going to sit home and do nothing." I mean, you've done a lot and crossed many paths doing it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's pretty interesting because when people read this book, they go on the journey with me, and then they start to look at their own lives, and they think, well, if Marla can get through this, or gosh, Marla was such a dumbass, I had a better life, or oh my God, that's so much like my life. So we all have these incredible lives to get where we are, JV.
Let's kind of start at the end of the story and move back just a little bit, because I'm really curious. Sometimes words come across my desk that I'm not entirely sure what the meaning is. And when I saw that you refer to yourself as a transformational psychic medium, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the transformational part means. What does that mean?
Well, all of us who do this work have we all have unique talents, right? So we all come at this in various ways. I was highly skeptical. So in the mid-90s, when this all started happening and I thought I was going crazy, I had to work really hard to make sense out of all of it. And there's also a trauma part of my background where I believe that the trauma actually heightened my sensitivities. So in working hard to make sense out of it by being trained by the U.S. military psychic spies, I also was in a lot of therapy to heal the dynamic, the trauma that was in my childhood, which really did heighten my sensitivities. So I consider that the transformational work. And the way that I work is I see patterns and probability factors psychically, and also I connect to the things that I understand the best with people, which is their emotional life. And that's, of course, with deceased loved ones.
So you've referenced it kind of gently here to begin with, but much of your childhood was challenging. And those challenges ultimately led you to where you are today. Talk a little bit about your childhood and what made it what might be considered the typical American childhood and what made it not so typical.
Well, thank you for asking that. Actually, the title American Psychic is based on the fact that my father was a World War II veteran who was in Germany blowing up Hitler's Siegfried Line, Rainbow Division, and he was blown up in a mine accident.
Oh, wow.
And came back to the States in a body cast. And he spent, you know, the rest of his life in pain and medicating that pain through alcohol. And my mother was from the South, and my father brought her up across the Mason-Dixon line to a life in Pennsylvania, and she was unhappy. And by the time that I was born, they'd weathered a lot of different things. They'd had a number of deaths, and my mother's dream of my father being an officer in the Army disappeared because he came back, you know, basically broken. And she was not a well woman. So her rage, she inflicted on me. And that that kind of abuse is something that I know many of our listeners probably understand. So that awareness as a child of having to intuit her also was me navigating her. I mean, I became highly intuitive just trying to intuit her, but also the psychological thing, JV, of splitting, you know, that terminology of disassociation.
Sure.
Where we split from our bodies. Well, I was learning that as a child, not thinking anywhere near the psychic ability of being able to remote view or bilocate my consciousness. So that happened to be going on during that time. And I love that you say I gently talk about it, because there's so many of us that are dealing with some form of trauma. I mean, trauma is an ongoing problem within our society. And healing that is our job on many levels.
I think that's profound, and I think that's quite true. And I think a lot of us carry a burden, a weight on our backs, based on some things that we don't know how to deal with or how to accept from our childhoods.
Right.
That can be a huge hurdle for a lot of people. Sometimes it inspires people, but either way, it's something that needs to be dealt with.
Well, yes, it does, because I mean, as my book talks about many of these wonderful stories, it could have gone a different way for me. I could have, never come back from Cuba. I could have been thrown in jail after I was basically hijacked. I was living with the mob. There were lots of situations that, interestingly enough, my intuition helped me get out of. And I think that that's another thing about the book. It really is about listening to that consciousness, whether you call it the universe, God, spirit. It's the voice that led me through a number of different situations. I mean, I was raised in the Lutheran church, and then I went through the born-again Christian world, and then I moved into a different world of being an actress, and consciousness started to change for me. And it was literally those U.S. military psychic spies, when this all started happening, that really saved me, JV.
And we're going to talk about all those different points in your life and how these sensitivities affected each of those things. I want to take you back to your childhood a little bit and your relationship with your mom. You say you had to intuit her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure I know what that means, but explain what that means.
Well, as a child, I didn't know when she was going to snap. One of the first stories that I detail in the book is how she tied me to a high chair when I was 3, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And she opened up a cupboard, and she got out a spoon, and she poured black pepper onto the spoon and shoved it in my mouth.
Oof.
And that dynamic at the age of 3 made me not trust her. And from that moment on, I had to be very conscientious. I mean, I love touching things, which is an interesting aspect of psychometry. When I first started working with law enforcement, holding crime scene photos, but I had to touch my food. I had to touch people. I loved touching fabric to make certain that I could feel safe with who and what I was doing. And, when something like that happens at the age of 3, you are looking out for you're in survival mode.
Yeah.
For much of your life.
Yeah. I need to say this too. I don't know what your relationship with your father was like, but I dearly loved him. Good. I do believe that the men and women that fought World War II are sincerely the greatest generation, and
I agree with you.
Deserve a tremendous amount of praise. And I don't know, I know you explained that your father was in a was wounded very seriously, came home and lived the rest of his life in pain. But the key is,
yes,
from what I understand, he lived his life, and he.
Oh, he did. Yes,
he did
live his life. And
go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just excited because he came back with, 2 bronze stars and a purple heart.
Wow.
And yeah. And yes, I completely agree with you about this.
Yeah.
And our veterans are suffering, the medication now and the way that it's all really about taking care of our sons and daughters who have gone to war and making sure that we try to keep them from having to go into those conflicts if necessary.
And I think one of the other things that's very important, I often tell my son is 24 years old, and he complains about taking the garbage out when I ask him to, you know. He's got his master's degree, but I can't get him to take the garbage out. You know, when he complains about things like that, I remind him, I said, you know, there were people 3 or 4 or 5 years younger than you storming the beaches at Normandy to save the world from a horrible dictator. You've got it pretty easy. So think about that. And I think, and the thing that also that makes them such a great generation, and this certainly isn't the topic of our conversation, but I get excited about it, is that after, after they won the war and did some unbelievable things, things that you can hardly imagine asking a person to do, they were asked to do, and they did it. They came back home and they started families, and they built this nation that, you know, still was basically recovering from a major depression. And much of the way you grew up, much of the way I grew up, was basically on their backs, that what they built for us. And they cannot be thanked enough.
Oh, I agree with you. And you know what? What an interesting time it really was. I mean, this was when television was becoming very popular, and I had, you know, Lucille Ricardo and Samantha Stevens to be my babysitters. Right. And it was that kind of time where our families, our parents, were still dealing with that vibration of trauma that they suffered from. And they were looking to their martinis and their Marlboros and just having as much fun as they could because they wanted to live. And I get that. And I also watched, you know, my father just incessantly in pain. And it wasn't the typical thing, JV, to be seeing a therapist. I mean, we were part of a generation that didn't understand that there was codependency that was being developed in those family dynamics where the mothers were a little crazy and the fathers were not available. The children were reaching out going, help me, give me some love here. How am I going to find this? Mom, Dad, you're not available. So we had to reach out. And some of us reached out to God and various organized religions, and other people reached out to the hippie movement and drugs and music. So what a curious time. I just downloaded last night onto my Pandora the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the oldies.
Yeah,
you know?
Mm-hmm. My favorite stuff. Now,
well, I don't remember the 60s that much, but you know what I'm saying? But those times were the richness. It's in our soul. It's in the good epigenetics of our DNA. And then there's, of course, the forefathers, you know, our dead relatives who keep trying desperately to teach us.
I don't remember the 60s that well either, but I remember my father listening to 60s music when I was in the 70s growing up. But these things are so transformational or transformative.
Yeah.
You know, these
and
are the,
they are, yes.
But when you were going through this part of your life as a child, were you aware of these sensitivities? Were you aware of the gifts that you now are completely aware of?
Well, you know, JV, I talk a little bit about that in the book. There are a couple of really interesting stories where something would just pop in. It was as though I would go blind to my present circumstances and a movie would start in my head. And it was about something else that was going on in the world. And I blurted it out. And of course, I got into trouble for that. But the dynamic was I was being shown something. And when I talked about it, it was validated. And that was a little creepy to my parents. And they, of course, they didn't support me in that. But I started to think, wow, this is curious. And my sister, who was 11 years older than me, brought the world of ESP and Kreskin into my life one Christmas, you know, with those cards that you try to identify with. But I didn't believe in any of it. I just thought it was sort of wild and wonderful that I could have this experience with my sister at such a young age. I mean, she was 11 years older than me. But this was not supported. There was an incident when I was just in seventh grade, I was turning 12 years old, and there was a classmate of mine who sat down with me for the first 2 weeks of lunch, and she was a tiny, toe-headed girl, a lot smaller than those of us who were even, you know, with our little model stick figures at that age. She was much smaller, and there was a moment where I kept looking at her, wanting to protect her, JV. There was something that made me take what I call a psychic snapshot of this girl. And she had wispy hair, and she talked really sweetly. And she was the eldest of these children living down in the valley, which is where my father had a hog farm. We lived in town, but we had this farm down there. And there was something about her that I really wanted to protect. Well, the first or the second week in school, the football game was happening, and everybody was going to go. But they kept announcing her name over the loudspeaker. And the next morning, my father mentioned that this girl from down in the valley had been raped and murdered.
Oh,
and that
wow.
was Kelly Jo.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
How old were you?
And
that, how old were you?
12. I was turning 12 the next week. And that murder changed everything for me. I didn't know what rape was, and I had to understand and hear my mother talk about these things over and over again. And I had a horse at the time, and I didn't want to go down to the farm anymore, and I didn't want to ride my horse. And it made me protect myself from my mother, because what she was doing to me behind the closed doors was inappropriate. And I started to learn things. That rape, that murder changed my life. And then there were two other murders in my small town the subsequent year, and I knew those people too. So that was basically one of the things that started to massage my consciousness to work with law enforcement on murder cases.
Wow. I can't imagine digesting an experience like that at 11, 12
yeah.
years old. I just can't. I mean, that has to be something you carry with you forever.
Yeah, you do. And interesting, so does the town, town that mm-hmm. I grew up in. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
So you mentioned when you were relating some of these early experiences that you had, that in retrospect, you can go back and say, ah, okay, that's now I understand what was going on there. Now I understand why I heard that voice.
Yes.
And you mentioned that, you know, your parents didn't really want to hear of it. And, you know, school probably didn't want to hear of it. Maybe even friends didn't want to hear of it. How often do you think a child with some of these sensitivities, such as yourself, are basically either punished or admonished into silence, and they tuck these abilities away because they've been told they have to, or they're afraid of being punished or ridiculed?
Well, that's a really good point. Or they're drugged.
Yes.
So let's take a look at organized religion. You know, I think that God speaks to us all the time in various ways. This larger consciousness system that most of us call God is constantly trying to get our attention about things. And we have the history of the Bible as an example of a text that, even though it's been probably dissected and edited 2,500 times, it is still part of the fabric of our nation. And it's also been cherry-picked in order to control people. But that dynamic is all about spirit and consciousness and vision and listening to God and having all of these incredible spiritual experiences. And the thing that I find most miraculous is not just the reincarnation of Christ, mm-hmm. but the release of his spirit, everlasting life, John 3:16. And God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son to die for us. And who shall ever believeth in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. And I've been talking to dead people, not believing that that was part of it, or the whole concept, JV, of born again. Did anybody ever think that that was reincarnation? I mean, we were taught that it was a card-carrying club that you had to become a member of in order to survive and go to heaven.
It's interesting when you pull the blinders back a little bit and you start to think in just in terms of an open mind, and you start to realize that so much of what we're seeing in our world today can be explained or assisted or aided by these ideas that we're talking about tonight.
Yeah. Well, everybody has it. That's the whole thing. And when you talk about, you know, this being discouraged and how many children... Well, children are having experiences, but parents, of course, well, whatever the children are doing that the parents don't like, they basically try and curtail it. Or because of all of the technology, children are stimulated. Their child sensibilities are not like what we had, going out into the world, the woods, and playing with other children. They have been focused on technology and getting immediate gratification, and that's not something that we had. So the intuition and the ability to access this larger consciousness system is available to us, and children are looking at it in different ways, and it's going on all over the world, whether it's the children who cover their eyes to see through this blind experience that they have, or what they call indigo children who are coming in, souls from, you know, another lifetime, or maybe just a few years ago, who've decided to come back in and help where we are. But that's a belief system.
Yeah.
And I know that you like to talk about that. So here we are.
Yeah. I'm curious as to what you, if you had to define this in a, and I don't want to pigeonhole it. However, do you believe this is spiritual in a religious sense? Do you believe this is mystical? Is it alien as an extraterrestrial? Is it interdimensional? Where does this energy and these sensitivities, where do they come from?
Well, let's use the science aspect of this. For the last 10 years, I've been working with Tom Campbell, who was a physicist, and he was a NASA defense guy, who actually was with Bob Monroe at the Monroe Institute with Dennis Menernick back in the 70s, developing the technology called HemiSync for the Monroe Institute. And HemiSync is the binaural beat system that a lot of people are using still. And it's, of course, where the U.S. military went to train with binaural beats to have access to altered states of consciousness without the use of drugs. So the science of this is accessing information. So this larger consciousness system that we call God, you could make it a computer or this just divine energy. I think it's everything that you said, JV. I think everything that you mentioned is all in there, because I think it's all about consciousness.
We talk a lot more about consciousness than we ever have, at least from what I'm seeing in the discussions we have on this program. And we're talking more about a matrix of consciousness and interconnected consciousness and a greater consciousness. Is that part of what we're talking about here?
That's it. Absolutely. You know, Tom teaches the virtual reality model. Now, I'm not a physicist, so I can't give you the exact modicum of his model. But the dynamic I like to use is, if God is the computer and we are these avatars, then we are the players, and our consciousness connected to Source, this computer, we are in this virtual reality. So that is all that also, you know, sort of slams the whole materialism idea down, because within the virtual reality model, there is room because of consciousness being spiritual, which is basically connecting to a source, which is downloading from that source, which is all about really growing up, lowering entropy, reducing all the chaos. And it's kind of like chaos, if you're thinking of gasoline fumes, when you lower the entropy into making it gasoline, you can do something with it. So we are lowering this chaotic entropy, and we're having a hard time with it right now in our country and all over the world, in making it about love, JV. That's the job, to grow up and find love.
Quick question, and then we'll retire this discussion about children and their sensitivities and as you experienced as a child. But this idea that parents and schools seem to teach us or scold us out of these sensitivities and these ideas. Is that a Western or an American thing, or is it global? Is this what we'll find all over the world, or are there cultures that actually embrace this, particularly in children?
Well, you know, the thing that comes to mind is Rudolf Steiner and the Waldorf schools. I don't know how many of your listeners have looked into Rudolf Steiner's principles, but the idea of expanding a child's mind and keeping the arts and keeping all of the things that are basically right-brained to inspire that left brain. It's both sides working together. I mean, when you defund various things for children's schools and you take away the arts and you take away the expression of them, they don't have a place to offer their emotions. You know, when we go back to that trauma piece, my God, had I not had the opportunity to sing in the choir, or, you know, I started, you know, being this precocious child and getting on stage very early, thank God, JV, so that I could express the internal problems and the stress and the pain and the suffering of the trauma instead of having it, you know, get stored inside the issues and make the issues in my tissues. I think it's crucial for children all over the world. And I don't happen to, you know, have lots of discussions with my friends that that are in different countries about their children, but I think that's a really good program. I think let's put that on the docket.
Yeah.
Let's get some of our friends from Europe and England, Germany, France, and Germany. My Germans. The Germans have been teaching us how to handle life ever since World War II. They've had to integrate that pain and that suffering in a very powerful way. So I'd love to hear from them about this.
You, as we get to know you a little bit better, one of the important episodes in your life was, the first career that you chose, which was that of stage, television, and film acting. How did you decide to do that? That's something a lot of people talk about, but not a lot of people pursue, and even fewer are successful at it.
Well, JV, when I was growing up, I saw that my mother, her face was lit with joy when she would watch her soap operas. She longed to be in front of that television set, and that's where she spent most of her life, reclined on that sofa. I don't know how many years I calculated, but I thought, wow, if I could get into that box in the corner of the room, then maybe she'll love me and not hurt me. So I remember being, you know, crawling up on the stage at the Trinity Lutheran Church to entertain the Rotary Club. I was singing on top of Old Smokey. And my mother was completely delighted. And I thought, I'm going to get into that box one day. And that was my focus. If I could, of course, I had some talent, but my drive was truly because I wanted my mother to love me.
That I think a lot of us do what we do to get our parents to, you know, I'm not going to for a minute think my parents didn't love me even when they weren't showing it at times, because I have to believe they did. And I do believe they did. However, we wanted their approval, and we wanted them to be proud of us. And many of our decisions in our lives based on that criteria.
Yes. Well, mine was a survival mechanism. You know, I part of the reason that I left acting was because I didn't, even though I had a great career and it was much, much, much fun, I didn't want to pretend anymore, JV. I had been trying to live an authentic life. And while my mother was alive, that was really hard. It's quite a challenge, and I'm so fortunate that of the work that I do and the people that I've worked with. You know, so many people have come to me and said, you know, I've had this similar pattern in my family, and it's just been devastating. How did you deal with it? How did you overcome it? And, you know, my mom was alive until 2004, and it was a constant, I had to keep checking my own integrity about what I was giving her. I didn't want to lie to her, but I had to. I didn't want to not share my life, but there were times where I just couldn't. And I found a way through therapy, of course, to be as authentic as I could. And, you know, and that caused ripples. And she, you know, fought back. When you're dealing with a narcissist who had control over you for so long and you start to stand up against it, you know, it creates problems. But it's the greatest thing I ever did. I remember Oprah saying, I think it was in the Golden Globes, that, you know, telling the truth was the most important power or the most powerful thing that we can do for ourselves. And that's what I did.
That's inspirational, actually. You've done so many cool things as an actress. I mean, I was looking through your IMDb page earlier, but I have to say the highlight for me, and it may not be the highlight for you, but the highlight for me was you were in a film called Ice Cream Man with my good friend David Naughton.
Oh, my God. Wait. First off, I'm so lazy about going in there and fixing all that stuff because, you know, when you look at me, there's a lot of stuff all over the web, and most of it's true, I think. But but you can't really control. I have to go back into Google and control them, because that whole thing with what my film career looked like, I didn't have a film career. I remember Barry Sonnenfeld, who called me and said, "Mala, I hate to tell you this, but I had to cut you out of my movie."
Oh.
You know, he had hired me to for this role and Get Shorty. You know, actually, we'll get back to that Ice Cream Man thing, but I'm laughing because I had a series of commercials that a lot of people probably will remember. I was the mom in this series called The Puttermans. It was this creepy doll-like family, and we were wearing Duracell batteries in our backs, and we were covered, you know, with prosthetic makeup.
This was an ad campaign?
Yes, it was an ad in the 90s. It ran for a couple of years, thank God. But it's quite funny, and you know, I didn't know whether you had seen the clips. I have clips on my YouTube channel of just a number of the shows that I did, and I was hoping that you were going to say that, you know, Peg Bundy beating me up and Married with Children was one of your favorite things. But that Ice Cream thing, I mean, I shot it for 2 days, and I, you know, most of it ends up on the cutting room floor.
Right.
And I'm, you know, it's just always that way, except in television. So I can't really say that my career, I did fly to Estonia to do a film with Brian Dennehy and Mia Kirshner.
Wow.
And Bronson Pinchot, Keith Carradine, who else was in there? Judd Hirsch. Mercedes Rule, great cast, terrible movie. But, you know, that was probably the last opportunity that I had. I sang in that movie. I played a cheesy cabaret singer. But the dynamic of how we get these jobs is just quite extraordinary. And I loved the career, but I wasn't destined to have a pilot. Every pilot that I did didn't go. You know, whether it was a guest starring role or a lead role. And I realized that was just completely okay with me. I loved being guest stars on Seinfeld and Married with Children and Everybody Loves Raymond. And I loved it. But can you believe that talking to the dead is more important to me and helping others accessing information for their highest good?
Well, that says a lot about you, and I have to make a confession right here. I've never seen Ice Cream Man. I actually screened it. I run a series of horror film conventions, and
yes, I understand that.
And I screened it because David Naughton was with us at one of these shows, and he's in that film. So I screened it, and that's as close as I've ever gotten to that film. I don't think I even knew it existed prior to that. But I just thought it was funny to bring it up.
Well, it is funny. It is funny, but when you look at my reel, if you ever take a look at that, it's up on YouTube. It's just those, how many shows can you get in 60 seconds, really?
Right.
But having Peg Bundy beat me up,
that's
was
classic.
Really a treasure. Yeah, that was treasure.
We have to go to break here in just a couple of minutes, so let's get an understanding of how you made the transition from acting, and I'm assuming this was the transition, moving from acting to what you just described as talking with dead people and helping other people. You made a decision to do that. What was the catalyst for that decision?
Well, I remember my agent calling me and saying to me, "You didn't go to your audition." And I said, "Oh, right. What were you doing, Marla?" "Well, I was talking to one of the CEOs of a corporation, bringing in his dead father and giving him information." Wow. And I thought, and she said, oh, you might really want to consider whether you want to continue this work or not. And I said, you're right. Yeah. And it was, I was on the set of, I think it was the last show that I did. It was with Drew Carey, the Drew Carey Show. And I had just done the opening scene with Wanda Sykes and Drew Carey. And I walked off the set, and Jerry Cohen, actually, who I had been directed by in during Married with Children, which was one of the first shows I did when I came to town, he said, great job, Marla. And it was a full circle. It had been 11 years since I had come into town and done that, you know, and done a show with Jerry. And I thought, I think this is it. It didn't move me anymore. I loved it, and I loved the people, and it was always so much fun. But I was so much more interested in being able to help people connect to love. And I said goodbye to it. I also said goodbye to my stage career in 1999. The last show I did was in Santa Monica playing Marlene Dietrich.
Oh, wow.
So I left that too. Got great reviews and just said, no, it's not important anymore.
I think you you have a real knack for seeing good in people, because my description of people from Hollywood is not quite so generous. I've worked with a lot of them, and I have a little more difficulty finding the good in everybody, but I do try. I really do try.
Maybe we need to talk about this.
When you were acting or even doing anything else, were you drawing on these abilities, these sensitivities to guide you in any way, to help you through maybe a difficult decision or just in the course of everyday work? Were you tapping into this all of the time?
Well, it was more like this, JV. I was praying a lot, saying, oh my God, just give me a job.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do talk about this in the book. It's kind of funny. I was stuck on the 101 freeway. It was in the early 90s, and I was like, oh my God, I need something. I need the stimulus of, you know, people working together, people, you know, that have problems coming together to work on them. And, oh, I need a stage show. That's what I said. I was pounding the steering wheel going, God, just give me a job. Give me a great stage show. And I got a call the next week from Jim Cordy, who happened to be the guy who found me in Chicago. It's my Schwab's, you know, drugstore story that he found me on a train and put me in my first stage show. But he said, Marla, I'm interested in you coming back to Chicago and playing Lena Lamont in Singing in the Rain. And I went, that's it. That's it. That's exactly what I needed. I was laughing a lot when this was first all starting for me. You know, was it my intention? Did God hear me? Was that show just primed for me? How did this all happen? And I'm still helping people figure out, you know, the intention of these amazing things that happen in our lives to help us grow.
We're talking tonight with Marla Freeze. Her website, which website do you prefer, Marla, the book site or your personal site, or doesn't it matter?
You know what? I think the book site is great because it gives you a lot of information about what I've been doing, and it's easy to order the book that way. But and it will take you to the other site if you're interested in contacting me. But it's marlafreeze.com and also AmericanPsychicBook.com.
Be sure to listen to part two of this interview with Marla Freeze. It is the next episode in your podcast lineup.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by JV Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.